This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Hello there, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and I'm your host today, along with Brandon.
Positive hedonism today, so.
You're pleased, one might even say you're pleasured, too. It's a pleasure to be on the show. How many pleasure points would you give the show for being on the show?
man, I'd probably have to, I'd say like an 8, but I might round it out to a 10.
Yeah, and we were talking earlier, you've had some negative aspects happening. So if you did an 8, maybe today was a negative 8. So your pleasure level is at 0. Your value of life is at 0 today.
I'm at rock bottom.
If your audience hasn't already noticed, today we're going to be talking a little bit about hedonism or positive hedonism, which is also really closely entwined with things like consequentialism and utilitarianism. This is a philosophical view I don't know that's been really covered on the show yet. I think it's one that a lot of people have a hard time taking seriously. However, it's also an interesting philosophical perspective because I think it's one in which a lot of people, whether they realize it or not, tacitly subscribe to in the way that they actually live their lives. Maybe not completely, but certainly some people, and I'm sure we'll get into examples like that. But positive hedonism, or we might call it hedonism, but we're sticking to some text today, so we'll say positive hedonism or hedonism interchangeably. To put it in the simplest form, it's a ethical system that analyzes welfare in terms of pleasure and pain. So an individual's well-being, an individual's welfare is determined, and by determined meaning whether it's good or bad, and there's all sorts of little ways we can parse that out, in terms of how much pleasure you're getting or how much pain. So obviously, but just to make things clear for audience, from the perspective of a positive hedonist, you are living a better life if you have more pleasure at any specific time or over the course of your lifetime. We can talk a little bit about how that, there's another way of kind of orienting that. But generally at any specific time, if you have considerably more pleasure than you do pain or no pain, then you are living a good life. And if you're in a position where you have considerably more pain than pleasure or perhaps no pleasure at all, well, then you're living a bad life. You're existing in a bad state of affairs.
Yeah, and I think the thing too, sticking with the text a little bit, something to notice is that this is a sort of framework or system for saying what is inherently good, right? Because all kinds of things in life seem good, and they either cash out to be good or not good. But at the end of the day, for the hedonist, as long as it cashes out in some kind of pleasure or in the avoidance of pain, in the end, even though, say, you have $5, well, $5 doesn't feel like, you know, strawberry lemonade when you hold it, but since you can go and buy some strawberry lemonade with $5, that's what makes $5 good. It's instrumentally good to what is actually intrinsically good, which is the pleasure of drinking a strawberry lemonade.
In the simplest form of positive hedonism, you know, all good roads lead to a sensory pleasure, right? The kind of like the base feel good sort of thing. If that's what's happening for you, then you're living an ethical life. You're living an ethically successful moral life. It even kind of sounds weird to say that because that's not the way we normally think about it. But it is in this system. It's kind of like, well, why would someone want to be rich? Like, what's the benefit of having boatloads and boatloads of money? Well, the obvious answer is, well, you can do all the pleasurable things that you want all the time if you have lots of money, right? Like, so it's that being rich is instrumentally good for accessing that sensory pleasure realm that is the real good of life. It's the real meaning of life. You did mention a second ago, sticking to the text today, we are actually focusing on a little review of this moral system from a specific book that is Stephen Looper's The Philosophy of Death, which might be a little bit unexpected considering the topic. But this is a textbook specifically on, you know, like I said, the philosophy of death. And within that, there is always going to be a lot of discussions of what is a good life, what is a bad life, why is life worth having. And so that's why we both thought, a pretty well done out section on what hedonism is. Because obviously, if one is to justify living, well, hedonism is one system for doing that, right? What's the point of being alive? What's the point of doing anything? Well, it's feeling good, right? And since we're talking about the text, I'm actually going to get us rolling, I'm going to read over Stephen Looper's, I think, quite concise but good definition of positive hedonism. So Looper says this about positive hedonism. For any subject S, so that's for any subject, the subject's experiencing pleasure at a specific time is the one and only thing that is intrinsically good for that subject at that time. And that subject's experience of pain at a specific time is the one and only thing that is intrinsically bad for that subject at that time. The more pleasure a subject experiences at a specific time, the amount of good depends on the intensity and the duration, the greater the intrinsic good for the subject at that time. The more pain a subject experiences at a particular time, the greater intrinsic bad the subject it is for that subject at that time. I'll read that one more time just because it is a little bit technically written, but I think it's a really concise.
Yeah, this is like a very... It's a very classical, like, analytic definition of...
So this is literally a definition for our listeners. So once again, positive hedonism is, for any subject, that subject's experience of pleasure at a particular time is the one and only thing that is intrinsically good for that subject at that time. And a subject's experience of pain at a particular time is the one and only thing that is intrinsically bad for a subject at that time. The more pleasure a subject experiences at a particular time, the amount depends on the intensity or the duration, the greater the intrinsic good for the subject at that time. The more pain a subject experiences at a particular time, the greater intrinsic bad experiences it for that time. So there's really two things to kind of, I think, review there before we kind of start getting into the little weeds a little bit more, which is basically, if I were to subscribe to positive hedonism, the only thing that matters for me at any particular time is whether or not I feel good or I feel bad. And that is determined by me feeling pleasure or me feeling pain. And then that both of those, you know, that pleasure time or that pain time can have basically its value exaggerated or decreased, or I guess you could even say put into a negative, depending on the intensity level or the length of that pleasure. So, you know, if you hook me up to, so you put me in a pleasure machine, you hook my brains up to a bunch of electrodes, and it just sends pure pleasure, like scientists have done with rats and stuff like that and various sorts of things. You know, you could have one, it's good for me that I'm experiencing that pleasure right at that moment. That's a simple good. And then you could imagine there's a knob or a dial that goes from 1 to 10, and it's like level 1 pleasure, level 10 pleasure. So you, within there, you can kind of crank it to any point. But like the best setting, I'd say the best scenario for, in a positive hedonist, and the reverse, just the exact reverse would be true when it comes to experiencing pain. But the worst scenario. But the best scenario for positive hedonist is one where I'm basically just hooked up to electrode, pleasure all the time. The duration is may perhaps never ending, and the intensity is turned up to 10 constantly. On the face of it, that is the best scenario.
Yeah, I mean, it's the best scenario. Considering too, I guess this is interesting. I was going to bring this up when I was bringing my strawberry lemonade example up. You mentioned earlier that hedonism is one that is kind of intuitive, and it's one that permeates our lives because we live in a world of pleasure and pain. But philosophically, it's kind of a It's kind of considered like a dead horse. It's very easy to just not take it seriously or something like that. And I think that the best case scenario for the Hedonist is one of these things that kind of showcases why sometimes philosophers might not be inclined to take it seriously, because the best case scenarios are just like these very constructed scenarios where you achieve the highest amount of pleasure. I think that this makes it philosophically interesting to try and argue for and to try and find cases. Well, first of all, if this doesn't seem to jive with our intuitions about what makes a moral system good or like what seems like a life worth living, well, then it's an interesting challenge of why. And we'll get into that when we bring up the three thought experiments. One of them, I think you're kind of already alluding to here, but when we get into it. But the other two is just that there really is something about pleasure that a good life has. And if this isn't it, as they say, if this is not the life, well, what happened to pleasure, right?
Within philosophy, it seems like hedonism is kind of a dead end, right? Like, you know, people, there have been people since we can go back to Platonic dialogues and stuff like that, where people are kind of arguing for this system. And obviously for our listeners, we'll get into some pretty obvious reasons why you're like, oh, I don't know about this. And we'll also get into some counters of trying to make it a little bit more palatable. But like you say, I think you're absolutely right. It does hit on something that is essential to a good life, because you know what? Living the some sort of opposite where you are some sort of rule bound, always giving, always of service, you know, living this hard tackle, hard scrabble life every day that just kind of sucks, even though you might be the morally best person. This is kind of alluding, this is some reversal of alluding to some other stuff we're going to talk about, but even if you might be the morally best person, it seems like something's missing. Like from that being, like, no one would look at that and be like, well, that's maybe an admirable life. That person is admirable. Perhaps you might even call them a moral saint, but very few people would want to switch positions with that individual whose life has kind of sucked at every moment. That being said, you know, as much as it's easy for us to kind of knock on hedonism, there are some things that are good about hedonism or as a system. I'll bring up one right out of the gate, which is, as we've already been kind of talking about it, you know, as, you know, for you listeners, we gave a pretty succinct little all-encapsulating description, our definition of hedonism, which kind of leads into the fact that hedonism is a very simple system. You know, a lot of philosophical and particularly ethical moral systems are known for being very complicated and difficult, and sort of, there's oftentimes a question of like, well, how this makes sense, but how would someone actually live this out? With hedonism, one of its virtues is its simplicity. Pleasure good, pain bad, seek pleasure, avoid pain. Mm-hmm. That's basically your motto.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? As soon as you start doing something like utilitarianism, which is when you start racking up the utiles or the sort of abstract units of pleasure and pain, even that layer of calculating them against each other already sort of complicates it beyond our everyday experience of moral reasoning. It not only does simple positive hedonism that hasn't sort of evolved into utilitarianism yet, it seems to the simplicity of it and the fact that, yes, there's like a general kind of weighing of one feeling against the other and like anticipating consequences for things, but the other side of that simplicity is that it is not only intuitive, but it actually does kind of seem to reflect our everyday moral reasoning. Like when we're actually thinking about the consequences of our actions in our day-to-day life, some of it, I think the good chunk of the hard thinking that we do goes beyond pleasure pain. We're talking about, you know, are we being truthful to like a friend's request? Is this, am I really doing what this person wants me to do for them? Am I being faithful to like my own values or something like that? But the vast majority of it is like, you know, this is the more pleasurable thing to do, or like, man, if I do that, I'm really going to screw myself over and I'm going to, you know, be pulling my hair out at the end of the day. And that's essentially hedonistic ways of thinking. Like, we just don't want the bad consequences. And so not only is it simple, it actually seems to be relatively intuitive and sort of pre-critical in a way. It's the one that people actually use.
I like the term pre-critical. I really like the term pre-critical for something like this, because it's kind of like, I think one way you can frame it is, although there, I'll get to a caveat with this, but you could say, you know, it's as simple as, you know, I walk over to the fridge of my house. There's cranberry juice and there's orange juice. You know, I think orange juice is better. It's going to be more pleasurable for me to drink the orange juice than the cranberry juice. It's not strawberry lemonade, but... Or maybe there is strawberry lemonade in there.
Okay, well, and, you know, then the morally correct thing to do is to drink...
Exactly. Is to drink strawberry lemonade. On the surface, it's like, yeah, that is actually how most of us think. A lot of us, pre-critically, you know, when we say pre-critically, it's, you know, the sense of, you know, when you just kind of operate out in the world without taking a step back and thinking things, you know, necessarily through, when you're just operating, that seems to be the operating methodology. But the caveat that I'll say immediately when I think about that is that sort of example works well, or works best, or is most obviously simplistic when you're dealing with things that don't necessarily involve other people. So the juice example is a good one, because actually it's questionable whether or not it's even a moral, like, act, because you're just picking one object over another. Now, when it becomes to something like, you know, oh, am I going to hang out with this person or hang out with that person, or am I going to, you know, lie or not lie, you know, then it becomes a little bit more difficult, right? If I'm going to walk up to someone and say someone asked me a question and I'm uncomfortable with telling them the truth, well, uncomfortability is a kind of pain. It might be more pleasurable for me to, you know, lie to them or whatever, which obviously presents some sort of problem. But it is seemingly maps on relatively well to the way in which many people, or I would say most of us, operate in our day to day, at least on some level.
Mm-hmm. I mean, there, just one last thing to make a distinction here, and then we'll go on to what you're going to say, but there's a distinction also to be, or maybe there's a distinction to be drawn, but there's also just a question to be asked about, like, okay, well, a theory is more or less like a sophisticated hypothesis or a sophisticated explanation. Hedonism might actually give us a sophisticated explanation of how people pre-critically reason, but that's completely different from whether people should be reasoning that in that way, right? There might be better ways to reason about these sorts of things.
Oh, I think that that's an absolutely essential point. Like, a normative theory of ethics or morality, which is what we're really talking about here in terms of positive hedonism, it's applying itself as a normative theory, is one in which we're saying, okay, this is the way in which people should act. This is the kind of, like, this is the distinction for the actual and the ethical for our listeners, right? And sometimes people will make this move when, you know, say, trying to stand up for something like positive hedonism, because they'll say, just as you're saying, well, this is actually how people act, or this is actually how people think. And there's value in making that point, for sure. But that's totally different than saying, and therefore it should be a normative ethical theory, because maybe, I mean, we can use examples, but one might say, look, there's been all sorts of societies and groups and even countries over history who have had a relatively universal moral outlook or activity, you know, more or less, you might say, that is obviously abhorrent or not okay or has serious issues. Those systems being there, or that being the kind of habituated way that people think and act in a quote unquote ethical manner, doesn't really have any bearing on whether or not a different moral or ethical system would be more legitimate or would be better, right? Like, just because a bunch of people think and act a certain way doesn't actually make it ethical. And I think that's one of the things that positive hedonists are people that do like it. It's very easy to fall into that trap of just being like, well, people do this all the time anyway, so boom, it is morality.
it might be descriptively powerful, but whether it's normatively powerful is another question.
But I was going to say, there's one more. This is a little bit more of a trickier, but there's one more benefit for positive hedonism. I think it's worth bringing up, which is it helps resolve an issue of commensability, which comes up in a system of FFX. Let me just actually, I'm going to read from the text because this is a little bit more nuanced. But as Luper says, each of us can assess our own welfare and the values of things that happen to us without working out how to equate one unit of one sort of good with one unit of another. For each of us, the only intrinsic good is our pleasure, and every other apparent good is actually an instrumental good, which we can rank in terms of how pleasing we find it. So basically, this comes back to hedonism's simplicity, but in a little bit of a different way. A lot of other moral systems, especially utilitarian and consequentialist type systems, they're going to also be concerned with goods and collecting goods and kind of accounting for goods. But they tend to be, shall we say, a little bit more complicated or nuanced, and therefore are going to split up those goods into different kinds of categories, and they're going to have different kinds of effects and values. This can make an equation type system really difficult. If you use this reductive methodology of hedonism, where basically every good just collapses into pleasure, then you no longer have this issue of necessarily comparing, you know, well, there's this type of good thing over here, but there's this type of good thing over here. How do we decide which is more gooder than the other?
Because you're only dealing with a single kind, right?
Yeah, exactly. Everything becomes a single kind, right? Everything becomes just towards pleasure. And as we were talking about earlier, either it's a pleasurable thing or it's a thing that's instrumental in getting to that pleasurable point. And that really all that matters is pleasure's intensity and duration. Right. Now, I want to immediately bring up a counter problem to this, because it seems like, oh, it simplifies things a lot. As I was reading through this, this is the problem that I kind of get, which is there becomes an issue of subjectivity immediately that's apparent to me, which is if pleasure is the only measurable thing, well, what pleasure feels like and how certain types of pleasures feel to specific kinds of individuals and what their value is going to be might look very different from person to person. So then everything is about pleasure, but I might experience drinking a Coca-Cola as more pleasurable than you might experience it, or I might actually find certain things painful or harmful. So tacking down what something is in terms of its kind of moral value becomes difficult. And really, to me, you end up in a system where you're just kind of like, the only system that you can kind of account for is a system of self-reporting of pleasure, right? I think that this feels good for me. Whether or not it feels good for you, I don't know. Which then comes back to an issue like we were talking about earlier of a sort of, well, how then does the system become normative, right? How has this become universally applicable as a system of ethics if the accounting aspect of it only makes sense like to one individual at a time?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the other thing too. Luper does bring this up. He says, matters will be stickier if we attempt to make interpersonal comparisons of welfare. However, it is not obvious how one unit of my pleasure relates to one unit of someone else's, which I think you're actually right to make this distinction more radical by bringing up the problem of not just commensurability between subjects, but the subjectivity of pleasure itself, because it's not just that, okay, well, let's say somehow we can ascertain that we get the same amount of pleasure from drinking a Coca-Cola, right? Let's say we can somehow ascertain that. Okay, well, if we could do that, then we could start reconciling with, we could start running the calculus. I would know your pleasure just as much as I know mine. Well, first of all, you're right. We can't know that, but also we vary in what pleases us, right? Some people like Coca-Cola, some people like Pepsi. So we're not working on a completely linear scale here. People's pleasures do vary. Now, I guess in some way you could say, well, okay, you don't like Pepsi, I do like Coke, I've got a Pepsi, you've got a Coke, let's just trade. And hedonism is a moral theory that tells us that that's the right thing to do, right? Well, I guess in a way, yeah, but at that point, then hedonism just remains this kind of descriptive theory, which might still be predictively powerful or something like that, but that seems more like a kind of social psychology than a moral theory.
Well, it doesn't implore us to act in certain ways.
Right. Yeah, that's true. Well, I guess it would. Yeah, it doesn't. I guess it doesn't insofar as like it's a descriptive theory. But like if you want my Pepsi and I don't give it to you, even though you could derive more pleasure from the Pepsi than I could because I hate Pepsi. I guess insofar as that case obtains, then it's a moral theory that says, Brandon, you're a bad person. You just give Hale the Pepsi, man, please just stop being weird about it. Things get sticky when there's more than one person to analyze the pleasure here.
Oh yeah. And I think they're about to get a little bit stickier too, because okay, like I guess kind of newsflash or sort of breaking the surprise here. One of the big issues, which I think has been tacit in everything we've been talking about so far, is that ethicists will say that the problem with hedonism, or one of the problems, is that it does exactly that. It reduces everything to pleasure. And it would seem, with a little bit of thought, that there are perhaps other values, other things that are good, other things that would be accounted for in an ethical theory or system that are not pleasure, right? That doesn't necessarily need to be painful, but they're just things that aren't, you know, sensory pleasure. It's as simple as that. And I think it's worthwhile to go through a few kind of famous thought experiments that sort of elucidate this problem with hedonism. Now, before we do, I just want to say, you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. My name is Hale, and with me today again is Brandon. And we're discussing hedonism or positive hedonism. So with that, I think it's worthwhile to jump into a few of these examples because they're a lot of fun. They're pretty famous. Maybe some of our listeners are familiar with them, but they're fun to talk about. They're from Thomas Nagel and Robert Nozick. I think both philosophers who have come up on the show before. I know Nagel has for sure, actually a few times. But let's talk. Well, let's go with Nagel's first. And for our listeners, I think maybe as we go through these examples, maybe think about what other values other than pleasure might be being elucidated or brought to the fro here with these sorts of descriptions. So Nagel's example is called the contented infantile man. So basically, these would say, oh well, if hedonism is so great, how about this scenario? So Nagel says this: while you are sleeping, I pour into your ear a potion that painlessly reduces your mental capacities to those of an infant, while also giving you great pleasure for the rest of your life. Suppose, too, that the life you have led was one in which you would have far less pleasure, but you would have developed friendships and written a few good books if you had not had the potion. So, again, this is the contented infantile man. Basically, Nagel's saying, well, look, if pleasure's so great, how about this? How about I make you like dumb and pleasurable, you know, happy as a pig in poop, as one might say, you know, and you can like you're gonna be reduced mentally significantly, but you're gonna feel good all the time. You're gonna feel happy all the time. You're gonna be laughing and rolling around in your blanket and doing whatever else for the rest of your life. Sounds pretty great. If pleasure is, you know, is the sort of North Star of all actions and lifestyles, then clearly, you know, wouldn't this hyper-pleasurized life be fantastic? And even he says, suppose to that life would led was one in which you would have far less pleasure, but this is an important point, a kind of a hint, but would have developed friendships and written a few good books. So, you know, if you didn't have the potion, instead you would live a relatively normal, maybe slightly difficult life, but you'd be a writer and you'd be well-read and you would also have some close friendships, but you wouldn't be pleasure all the time. Obviously, most people would not pick the infantilizing, basically the dumbing potion, the potion that makes you dumb.
No one would voluntarily become infantilized like this.
It seems highly unlikely that people would want to do that, as Nagel is pointing out. But